Do you feel like you need God's encouragement and wisdom throughout the week to take hold of His promise to fly like an eagle? You've come to the right place. Welcome to Eagles on the Hill. Let's join our host, Pastor Jeff Shike.
Hey, people, I am your host, Pastor Jeff Shike. Thanks for joining us on this edition of the podcast. Every once in a while on the podcast, I want to bring forth for you a book that I've read that interested me, that I thought was interesting, that I thought you might be interested in taking a look at, finding out more about. And so this is one of those times. And the book is called The End of Race Politics. And the subtitle is Arguments for a Colorblind America. And by that, colorblind America, the author does not mean that we don't see color, because obviously we can see if a person is a particular color skin or not. But he says that he's essentially saying, if I could put words in his mouth, I don't have a quote for this exactly, but essentially saying that our skin color does not matter. What matters is the content of our character, etc., etc. And so if you're watching on YouTube, now you know what race this person is who wrote the book. Coleman Hughes is his name. Coleman Hughes had an appearance on The View, I think back in April or so of 2024, promoting his book, and got an interesting reception on The View, the TV show The View. Some people were had read the book a couple times and came ready to argue with him about what he wrote in the book, and other people seemed to be more in agreement with him. It was a couple lines that he said that the audience, the live audience, clapped a lot for, and that kind of thing. So it was an interesting kind of debate. You can look it up. I think it's probably on YouTube there, or somewhere you could find this episode of The View that had Coleman Hughes. And then they passed out a copy of the book to the whole audience, so they got a chance to take it home and read it. So anyway, I read, not because it was on The View, I read, though, The End of Race Politics by Coleman Hughes. I thought it was very interesting. Wanted to do a podcast on it. Specifically wanted to do a podcast where I talked about chapter 6 of the book, and just to see what you think of some of these things that he puts in here. Before I get into that, one of the things that was a little confusing about the book, so I want to make sure I get to this so that you're not confused as you read it, is normally the term anti-racist in the United States is a term that I don't know if Ibram X. Kendi is the person who invented the term, but it's used by him. And Coleman Hughes says that Ibram X. Kendi and his view of being and wanting to encourage people to be anti-racist is wrong. And he's arguing against Ibram X. Kendi in the book. However, what Coleman Hughes, and he terms what Ibram X. Kendi is a neo-racist. Then Coleman Hughes wants to adopt for himself the moniker of anti-racist and use it to be parallel to the term colorblind. So in other words, my point of this is that Coleman Hughes in the book uses the term anti-racist to mean two different things. He uses anti-racist to describe his own view of colorblindness, and he uses anti-racism the way Ibram X. Kendi uses it to describe what Coleman Hughes would call a neo-racist. So that's a little confusing in the book. You have to figure out, as he uses that term, who he's talking about and what the term means. All right, let's get into chapter 6 of the book. Why chapter 6? Because chapter 6 is entitled Solving the Problem of Racism in America. And I, for one, you, for another, would love to solve the problem of racism in America. I don't think we'll ever solve it totally because we're human, we're sinners. But these are some things that a list of prescriptions, if you will, that he gives to at least get further down the road of solving the problem of racism in America. And I wanted to go through them with you, read from the book a little bit, and see what you think. So first one, he says, is reconceiving diversity. He talks about the slogan that we often hear, diversity is our strength. And he says, you know, that slogan could be true from time to time, but it's a platitude that's really not actually true. We need to call it out. Diversity is not necessarily our strength. He says, Earth, Wind, and Fire, if you're familiar with that band from years ago, nobody really believes that Earth, Wind, and Fire would have been better if they had a white musician. Nobody cares. Nor do people believe that the Beatles would have been that much better as long as they had a Hispanic bandmate to round out their sound. Nobody goes into a Mexican restaurant and thinks, you know, that would have been a fantastic meal, except their kitchen really needs some white people. Nobody says that. So this whole idea of diversity is our strength, he says, it's kind of a platitude. We need to reconceive diversity and what it does and what it doesn't do. Second thing he says in the chapter is, this part of the chapter is called Stigmatizing Race Talk. And he says that right now in American society, calling a black person the N-word is highly stigmatized. I would add, he didn't say this here, but I would add it's stigmatized for a white person to call a black person the N-word. It's not typically stigmatized for a black person to call a black person the N-word. I would say that's an issue, and he might too. Anyway, he says it's good to stigmatize a white person calling a black person the N-word, but he says in our culture, racial slurs directed against white people are not stigmatized, and that neo-racist double standard is toxic. And so then he talks about that a little bit here. So that's that part of the chapter. He wants all that kind of racist talk to be stigmatized. Next thing, next section of the chapter, fighting racial discrimination against minorities. Fighting racial discrimination against minorities. And he says some interesting stuff, I think, in this section. I'll just put my bias in there. He talks about how oftentimes, and studies have shown, that when that educators in particular, but that represents really all of us, if you know papers are turned in and there's a name on the paper that the educator that might match the educator's race or might be pleasing to the educator, he might have a, or he or she might have a good relationship with that student perhaps, that they tend to get a better grade. But if the paper is handed in with a name that would be typically, let's say, of a different race, a minority, that the same paper, if it had a different name on it, would get a better grade, but because it has a minority name, apparently, gets a lower grade. And so he advocates here in education, in this section, that systems be put in place so that papers, tests, etc., are graded based on the actual performance of the student, not based on their race. And so he talks about how that can be done and how some schools have done that and so forth. It's very interesting. I think it's pretty interesting. He says it might be hard. It might be costly to implement. But if the level of concern about racism expressed by our elite institutions in 2020 was in any way genuine, then key decision makers should acknowledge the importance of colorblind processes and should be willing to think creatively in order to implement them. Good to me. I'll just put that out there. All right. Next section of the chapter is called The Limits of Equity. The Limits of Equity. And basically what this section is saying is that there's problems with efforts to achieve equity. In other words, equity, just so you know, the difference between equity and equality. Equity is equal outcomes. Equality is equal opportunity. So equality is equal opportunity. Equity, the way it's used today in our culture, is equal outcomes. And he says the two problems with efforts to achieve equity, that is equal outcomes. First, in order to achieve equal outcomes across the board, you have to kill cultural diversity. And he talks about that. And then he says, second, achieving equity simply by fiat, that is by lowering standards of entry for underrepresented groups, does nothing to equip people with the knowledge, skills, and habits required to succeed. Equity by fiat is merely the illusion of equity. And of course, it has all kinds of other problems associated with it. And so he basically is saying in this section of this chapter that we need to stop striving for equity, equal outcomes, but rather strive for equality. All right, next section, we got three more sections of this chapter to go, and you'll get the sense of this, and you can see whether you think these prescriptions will be helpful. Next section is called The Uncomfortable Truth About Affirmative Action. The Uncomfortable Truth About Affirmative Action. He says, when reality makes us queasy, we use euphemisms. So during the George W. Bush administration, for instance, people began using the term enhanced interrogation to refer to torture. Why? Because unlike the word torture, the phrase enhanced interrogation could mean anything. It doesn't call to mind blood-curdling screams and hellish torture chambers. The phrase therefore provided cover for abuses that it referred to. Whether you or not you agree with that, that they were abuses, that's not the point. You get the point. He doesn't mention this, but another kind of classic case in our culture is the use of the term women's health care to refer to abortion. we don't want to think about or use the term abortion, so we use the term women's health care as a euphemism. So then he says, let me go back to him. He says, we use the phrase affirmative action for the same reason. It's a euphemism. It's a phrase that could mean literally anything. If you don't know what it meant, the words could give you no hint. The truth is, we don't want to really call to mind what the actual policy of affirmative action is. Namely, what is it really? He says, racial discrimination. We don't want to see how the sausage is made. The bureaucratic phrase affirmative action provides rhetorical cover for the practice of discriminating against people on the basis of their race. So there you go. Then he calls that the uncomfortable truth of affirmative action. And he speaks against that. So what is he, and this is quite a long section of the chapter. We'll see here what he wants to promote is policies, practices that are not necessarily designed to help people or treat people according to their race, but he is in favor of policies and procedures, practices that treat people according to their socioeconomic condition. Because, he says, and this came out on The View as well in his segment on television, because he says we all want to help people who are disadvantaged, but we should not be simply throwing help at race. We should be giving help and caring for disadvantaged. Now, in our society, he says, you can examine whether this is true or not. Again, that's why I'm throwing it out there. He says that when we help people based on their socioeconomic condition, we will wind up helping more minorities than majority population. But that's okay, because we are helping those people that we want to help based on socioeconomic condition. All right, back to the book. Two more sections of chapter six, and then we'll close out. The limits of race-based policies. So let's see what I'll read here. Race-based policies, as opposed to class-based policies, which I just described for you, race-based policies tend to benefit the people of that race who need them the least. Think of those who benefited from the race-based policies implemented in response to George Floyd's murder. Overwhelmingly, they were relatively wealthy individuals who had little in common with Floyd. Not income, not background, not position in society, not job description. The only thing they had in common with George Floyd was skin color. And many of them, Hispanics, Asians, white women, did not even share that. After the George Floyd murder in 2020, he says, companies began announcing they were going to start investing more in diversity. So the state of California announced it was going to require boards of publicly traded companies headquartered in the state to be racially diverse. Microsoft announced it was going to double the number of Black employees in managerial positions. CBS announced that it was establishing a racial diversity quota for its writers' rooms. And he says those things simply help people who didn't need help, but who fit the right race. And he rather advocates for helping people who need it based on class, based on socioeconomic condition. The limits of race-based policies is that part. And the last section of this chapter, anti-racist alternatives to affirmative action. Now, here's where he's using that term anti-racist to mean what he believes. So I would translate this for us as colorblind alternatives to affirmative action. And here he says something very interesting. Again, let me know what you think of this. He says, and he's quoting a Princeton sociologist, Thomas Espenshade. And this is the quote. If affirmative action is abolished, selective colleges and universities will face a stark choice. They can try to manufacture diversity by giving more weight in admissions to those factors that are sometimes close substitutes for race. For example, having overcome disadvantage in a poor urban neighborhood. Or they can take a far bolder step, putting their endowments and influence behind a comprehensive effort to close the learning gap that starts at birth. Higher education has responsibility for all education. So you get what he's saying there? He's saying that these universities with their huge endowments need to start taking some of those endowments and make a bold step. Use those endowments to work a comprehensive effort to close the learning gap that starts at birth. In other words, not just pay for kids to go to Harvard, but rather use the endowments to pay for kids in kindergarten in the hopes that one day they will be able to go to Harvard, and not just because Harvard reduces admission requirements or gets you in by your race. but actually succeed and be able to get into Harvard by what you've done. It's very interesting. I would add to this, and this is me adding to this, although he kind of goes here with charter schools, but I would add to this that putting our money where our mouth is, anti-racist alternatives or colorblind alternatives to affirmative action, school choice is the way to go. Studies show all the time that school choice, parents being able to choose what school their child goes to, and money not going to just government schools, public schools, but money following the kids to whatever school they go to, makes all schools better, public schools and private schools and charter schools and all the rest. All right, so there you have it. That's the book, The End of Race Politics. What do you think? As you heard that, are you intrigued to go out to read it, to purchase it? If so, I'm going to call Coleman Hughes and ask for some share of the profits. No, I'm just kidding. But hopefully it's something that will help you think about race in America. It's, you know, it's been a challenge for us. Well, it's a challenge all around the world, actually, but we experience it here in America in some severe ways. And we want to work toward a more just, more colorblind society. So that's what we got for you. Write us at eaglesonthehill211@gmail.com. Let me know what you think of this podcast or others. Remember that those who hope in the Lord will fly on wings like eagles. Thanks for listening to the podcast today.